Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Professor Anne Pender makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute after nearly a decade. Professor Pender is Professor of English and Theatre Studies at the University of New England. She's an author of some half a dozen books, but most recently, Seven Big Australians, Adventures with Comic Actors. And we've got some copies of that tonight, and we'll be selling it after the event. And tonight, Professor Pender's going to speak for us on the topic of Adventures with Australian Comic Actors, What's Happened to Australian Satire. And Pender, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne and Gerard, for inviting me to the Sydney Institute. It's a great pleasure to be here. So I want to talk to you about some of the extraordinary things I learned through writing this book about seven Australian comic actors. And I particularly wanted to talk about the making of satire in Australia by two of the subjects of the book, because satire seems to be almost a lost art at the moment in Australia. Now, I've dedicated the book to John Clarke. John was one of the first actors I interviewed some years ago now. And he was a tireless interviewee, as you can imagine, giving up hours of time to talk to me about his process of writing, his approach to performance, his very difficult childhood, and the fault lines, many fault lines of his career. So John and I became friends over the years, and we spoke to each other by phone every week for a very long time, and we were in touch just a few days before he died in April 2017. So it was through talking to John all those years ago at the beginning and through doing research for my full biography of Barry Humphries that I realised how important the lives of so many of our actors are and how important they are to our cultural life. Barry Humphries, of course, pioneered topical, referential, satirical comedy in Australia in the 50s, all that time ago. Carol Rae, Max Gillies, John, and others developed it and brought innovation to it. We can go back. We just leave it on the cover. Thanks. So there's a lineage in the book that I'm exploring, with one satirist building on the other. But it seemed to me that the actors' lives, their careers and their views were really documented. Until recently, they weren't regarded as serious subjects for study. And all of that has changed. So the book, Seven Big Australians, tells the story in what you might call a collective biography of Australian comedy on stage and television over half a century, but through the perspectives of the actors themselves. The key figures, Carol Rae, Barry Humphries, Nolene Brown, Max Gillies, John Clarke, Tony Sheldon, and Denise Scott. Now in Australia, Carol Rae is remembered for many achievements. I'm sure you all know who she is and remember her, but particularly for producing and starring in the Mavis Bramston show. Within weeks of arriving in Sydney in 1964, Carol had been appointed as live program consultant at Channel 7 with a brief to produce a late night show. This is a new thing, except for in Melbourne, but they wanted it to rival Kennedy's In Melbourne Tonight. And in her head, Carol told me that she envisaged a satirical sketch show, something like That Was the Week That Was, which she'd seen in London. She found her funny man in the English actor Gordon Chater, who was living in Sydney, and her straight man in Barry Creighton, the boy from Brisbane. So if we move on. I wanted to say that Carol had begun her career in the war, in the West End, and she danced and sang. She was in film and on stage in the West End throughout the war, even when there were the bombing raids. And in fact, that picture was taken in front of mirrors. There was a bomb that fell right near the theatre she was in when she was doing that one night, and she was very lucky to survive. A lot of the plaster came down. Fortunately, the steel cap lights didn't hit her on the head. She was very lucky to survive. Excuse me. But she was unable to find a woman for the show, so she ended up playing in the pilot herself, as well as producing the show. A huge amount of work. She had difficulty finding writers because there weren't very many writers she could draw on at the beginning, at that time. And as you may recall, Mavis Branston was an immediate success. The humour was sharp, it was satirical, nothing was off limits. It was really new for Australia. The Vietnam War was satirised. There were jokes about the pill, the foibles of Robert Menzies. The PM came in for a pasting. Censorship and social mores were frequent targets. Even the death penalty in Victoria was a subject for a sketch. I found that very interesting. With Carol singing a song about Henry Bolte questioning the barbaric practice in a lyrical lament, and she sang it for me. She's 95 and going strong. She said, "Dear Henry Bolte, does it have to be this way?" There she is. It was tame in some respects by today's standards. The language was tame by today's standards, but it did upset people. Questions were raised in Parliament about the show. Gordon Chater was accused of being a vulgar entertainer, and Alan Hulme in the federal parliament was forced to defend satire and he said that he sympathised and that it needed to have some licence. But looking back on all of this, and there was a terrible fuss about the show at the time, Carol laughed when she told me. She said, "But remember back then, nobody had even said bum on television." So it was a very different time. So we can have another look at Mavis Branston. And that's Maggie Dentz, who played Mavis but did most of the promotional work going around Australia in the outfit for the sponsor, which I think was Caltex. And there's Carol in the middle there with Gordon and Barry. And then later she got Jim Salter and some other actors, and she could concentrate on the production. So with this book, I followed each of the seven actors around for about 5 years. I actually followed a lot more actors around, but then I ended up focusing on the comic actors. So I talked to them at home, in their homes, in restaurants, backstage, before and after shows, in hotels as they toured here and overseas, and on the streets on long walks, if they would do long walks with me. And one day in Melbourne, Max Gillies and I got caught up in a very noisy Stop Adani demo in Collins Street, and I thought, oh, this is the end. No, Max was unfazed. He just kept talking over the drums and over the shouting, and I kept listening. So each actor profiled in the book pioneered something new. They developed something innovative in Australian comedy at a critical point in our history. Carol, Max and John in political and topical satire, Barry in the one-man show and social satire, Nolene in the game show and a kind of social comedy as well, Tony Sheldon in musical comedy, and Denise Scott in stand-up, and I'll come back to her later. So I spent hours, days, talking to the actors about their childhood, their parents, any training they had, and about their whole careers. One of the extraordinary things I learned was that in the early 70s, actors were instrumental in the Make It Australian campaign that brought about huge changes in Australia to Australian content on television. Before that, there was very little content, Australian content on television. Audiences were deluged with American sitcoms and soaps and so forth. There was some Australian, new Australian drama coming on in the 60s, but the Make It Australian campaign was really important. And what I was thinking when they were all talking to me about this was that the issue of the potential for saturation of our culture by other dominant cultures is a live one again. now, with the ever-increasing opportunity for downloading of cultural content from other places, mainly the US, but other countries as well. But what I wanted to say, the point I wanted to make about the Make It Australian campaign, another separate point, is that the actors won an industrial victory at the time. Before this, they were not paid for their rehearsal time for stage productions, which is extraordinary to think of now. It meant that they couldn't really make a living in the business. So now, of course, their work is much more valued and rewarded, although it has to be said that acting is still a precarious profession, and the hardships of the industry came through in many a story told to me by the actors. So, move on. Excuse me. I want to talk to you now about my adventures with John Clarke. And the first time I interviewed John was on the subject of Barry Humphries, because he had worked with Humphries in the first Barry McKenzie film. And the subject of performance was central to our discussions, but it was also a difficult topic for John. His attitude towards drama and live performance, and what he regarded as the quaint traditions of the theatre particularly, intrigued me, and I found it quite perplexing and actually quite confusing at the beginning. In fact, John's aversion to serious or dramatic acting was both a mindset and a mask, and it surprised me, and it took me a long time to unravel with him. In his early years, Clarke refused to play in anything dramatic. He'd had no training as an actor in the formal sense, and he's one of many actors of his generation who had no formal training in an institution or a studio. In fact, none of the actors in this book had formal training. Gillies, Sheldon, Ray, Brown, Humphries, Denise Scott, they're all in that category. They didn't have formal training. It doesn't mean they might have not have done a small course or something, but they really were not trained. Nor did John have any training in television. He learned on the job. He first appeared on stage at Victoria University in Wellington at the Memorial Theatre in 1969. He was enrolled as a student in an arts law course and gravitated to theatrical review, initially working backstage, where he told me there was free beer on offer. And he told me about his general lack of direction as a young man. He'd been forced to testify in his parents' divorce case, and he was quite wounded by it and quite aimless, he said. His father's barrister had attempted to convince the court that the problems between Clarke's parents were caused by John, and he portrayed him as very difficult. Well, he knew enough from his limited exposure to studying law that he didn't have to say anything, so he didn't in the court. But he did leave New Zealand at that point, and he went to London. He worked as a van driver for Harrods, but he told me that he'd park it outside the British Museum and leave it there with the back open and wander around all day looking at the exhibitions and not doing the deliveries at all. So throughout his career, he disguised his acting by seeming to play himself. His nasal voice, laconic manner, were part of almost every role, as you'll remember, and it was an ingenious mask. But how did he develop the mask? Well, his friend, Jeanette MacDonald, also an actor, a New Zealand actor who was living in London at the time, talked him into auditioning for Humphries and Beresford's film. And he carefully explained to me that if he'd not experienced that work with Humphries, he would not have created Fred Dagg in the picture or had any confidence to create satirical television later on. And he remembered, he told me he noticed that Humphries performed for a world audience, and while he parodied the cultural cringe, he and Beresford asserted their equality with everything and anything British at every opportunity. And he felt he could be himself with these men, but better still, he could play himself in the film, appearing in the pub scenes, doing just what he did every afternoon, drinking with Baz and McKenzie. So being permitted to play himself was the key to Clarke's performance style and his future as a satirist. Not only did it offer him a strangely comforting armour, but it later provided a satirical weapon and a mode of directly addressing the audience. So the mask, I'm arguing, and much more fully in the book, is the way that Clarke resolved the problem of drama as an actor, reconciling who he is through playing in a particular way. And you'll recall from the game the same character, the same mask. Every actor has to do this. Every actor has to resolve this problem. And John did it through a string of comic roles, often coated with black humour. And that provided the meeting of the actor and the acting. So remember, without the distraction of mimicry in Clark and Dorr, the audience could focus on the words and the interaction of the two performers. So Clark's writing and his approach to acting transformed sketch on Australian television. His sketches are highly structured and nuanced. They're a compelling element of a democratic project in which satire plays a vital part. So if we could have a quick look at one episode from 2014, that would be great, of Clark and Dorr when Abbott was Prime Minister.
Thanks for your time.
Good evening, Brian. Very good to be with you.
Now, you're a spin doctor with the government.
Well, can I stop you there, Brian? That's a pejorative term. That's certainly not the way I would characterise the sort of work.
How would you
describe it? Well, Brian, I'm a linguistics advisor to a predominantly Christian management group in the Canberra area. It is interesting work, very.
Mm. Are there a lot of it?
Linguistics advisors?
Yeah.
Yeah, about 1,500 of us, Brian. I mean,
why do you need so many linguistic advisors?
Well, Brian, think of it as a college for the interpretation of the scripture.
So they're studying the text?
Oh, yes, Brian. We look at the parables, the 10 principal negotiating positions.
Which are?
But they're just 10 sort of agreed starting points for a discussion.
Where did they come from?
Moses, I think, Brian's before. Brian, I certainly wouldn't be advising the minister to accept that term.
But that's what they're called, the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, I'd be advising him to reject that term.
Why?
Not too restrictive, Brian. You don't want to go into a negotiating position with no malleability. You've got to have room.
You said it was a Christian management group. Surely you must have Christian policies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're Christians. Of course they do.
Well, what else do they study?
Oh, well, you know, everything, Brian. The left-wing lecture in the hills.
Sermon on the Mount.
That's the one. They retain their beauty, in my view.
That's the ones here. Blessed are the persecuted, for they shall be blamed for their persecution.
That's a very early draft, Brian.
Blessed are the meek, for they shall get stuff.
Where did you get that? You shouldn't even have that. That's classified.
Well, let's go to a practical example. In the last couple of weeks, some Tamil asylum seekers were locked in a jail in the desert and then flown from there to Nauru.
Yes.
Were you providing advice on how to deal with the problem?
Yes, Brian, I was. This is what I do.
Two jails in a week?
Yeah, that's actually not the angle we went with.
Because, no, you said you were trying to send a signal to people smugglers.
That's the one we went with, Brian. We need to put these people smugglers out of business.
But that's not the fault of the people who are trying to escape persecution, is it?
No, a lot of this is going out on talkback radio, though, Brian. I mean, you don't want to get too technical.
So why do it on talkback
radio? So you don't have to get too technical.
You also said this policy is designed to prevent drownings.
Yeah. That was one of my better ones, wasn't it? I was surprised that one got a run in the paper, to be honest.
Are you a Christian?
Oh, yeah, we're all Christians up there.
You believe there's a day of judgment?
Oh, judgment, Brian.
I think you better have another look at that book.
I should probably read the book at some point,
yeah.
It's pretty big. We're quite busy.
Thanks, Paige. I think it's one of the finest of the episodes of 20 years he was doing Clark and Dorr, and still pertinent. The target spin in relation to Christian values is as potent today as when it was first broadcast. Clark was prescient, I think. So with Clark, we really have lost a genius, and it seems there is no one producing such witty satire. So I'll turn now to my adventures with Max Gillies. Max, like John, experienced a difficult childhood in the shadow of World War II, and like John, his early life was affected by his father's damaged state after he returned from war service. Max started out in Melbourne at the Pram Factory with a group of performers called the Australian Performing Group, who favoured the performer as the chief creator rather than the director or the writer, and that was quite new. And you may remember his impersonations of politicians on stage, which he did for a long time, and then on television in the 1980s in the Gillies Report. And the show revived the tradition of performing in front of a live audience, just like Mavis Bramston. The writing in the series was politically astute and perfectly attuned to the theatre of politics in Australia. It was broadcast weekly and centred around Gillies, who played all the politicians of the day. Fraser, Hawke, you can see some of them there, Peacock, Whitlam, Gorbachev, Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And his laconic opening lines in the first episode set the mood of the show. He said, "Hello, I'm Max Gillies, and most of the people you'll be seeing tonight aren't." So it's very much about the performer. And his stories that I was lucky enough to hear of how he prepared to embody Hawk, I found really captivating. He told me that when Hawk was elected, he panicked. He suddenly had a problem. For the first time in years, Australians had elected a moderate, and what's more, someone Max liked. He couldn't imagine how to mock this charismatic man of the people. The inspiration, though, came via Don Watson, who was his writing partner. Watson was a history teacher at the time, and Max told me that one of Don's students had pointed out a similarity between Bob Hawke and an American televangelist. So Gillies and Watson spent a couple of Sunday mornings entranced by the Hour of Power, with its slick, fast-talking star preaching in a glass cathedral in California. Suddenly, it all made sense. Hawke's father had been a minister, after all, and his son revelled in the showmanship of politics. The theatricality of the man would be vital to any parody. He was sure it could drive the impersonation, and so it did. So he wasted no time in ordering a shiny suit, sharply cut shirts with long cuffs, and sparkling oversized cufflinks. I think we've got a picture of him in his suit. and he ordered that very expensive wig, he told me. And so he watched The Hour of Power over and over again, followed by footage of Hawke addressing the press club, observing the mannerisms and the gestures and listening to his intonation and syntax and watching the facial expressions in order to play the short, bumptious union man come national hero. He played Hawke with such flair that many mistook him for the Prime Minister. And he even appeared as Hawke in Hawke's presence, addressing the North Melbourne Football Club Grand Final breakfast, in character as the PM. Now, it's really unusual for performers to appear in the presence of those they impersonate, and it was the first and only time, as far as I know, in Australian history that a Prime Minister had allowed it. But his ambivalence, I mean, Hawke's ambivalence, was quite clear to close observers and to Gillies on the day. Shaking hands with everyone at the high table, Gillies, dressed in the suit, ran the gauntlet of the club president, the Lord Mayor of Melbourne, finally reaching the man himself, Robert James Lee Hawke. And he told me that the leering Prime Minister grabbed Gillies' hand so vigorously his wrist throbbed, and before he knew it had pulled him into a tight face-to-face with cameras flashing all around them. Gillies blinked as Hawke suddenly let go of his hand and brought his fist to Max's nose, punching him in a sort of playful bop as he turned to approach the podium to give his address as the man who had just hit him. So it was Max interpreted it as a sort of playful but not painless preemptive alpha male warning to the actor. It's really difficult to imagine anything like that now with security and all that we have now. But to give a sense of Max's range, and it was extraordinary, I'd like to just have a quick look at another one where he is remembering the constitutional crisis of 1975, and he plays about six different characters. That's John, of course.
Of hugely overproduced and increasingly baroque big budget versions of the dreadful, tawdry, and pitifully shameful events of our recent history, we proudly present the following attempt to gloss over the facts. Live from the Victorian Arts Centre and a bigger waste of money than the roof, we present Il Dismalissimo, Il Dismale, Al Pacino. We present the following musical tribute to November the 11th.
Nations need up, power and fame are mine. We have 3 years of labor, wherein because we said it's time, and thy proof be for sublime. The odds have had increased funding. How do you like blue coal? Rick's City Dolls, Kim Lottie.
And we only need hot chocolate.
Good boy.
It's time, all right. Time got, you know, pissed off. Something must be done. I know. I'll go see the GG.
It goes for a lot longer, and he plays the Queen as well, so it's well worth watching to show the versatility of the actor. Well, we need satire. It's central to the democratic process, and it's no surprise that John Clarke, who wrote all of the scripts for Clarke and Dorr, saw himself as one of the audience, not as an actor mouthing lines written by someone else, but as a participant in the democracy trying to make sense of the main issues and main players. That was his satirist's moral ground. He attempts to say what we can't. Clarke wrote the apology to the Indigenous people of Australia that was delivered by John Howard, the actor, in an episode of The Games in 2000. I don't have that, but there's a picture of the actor delivering it very straight. The apology took aim at the fact that the real Prime Minister, John Howard, steadfastly refused to make an apology to the Aboriginal people of Australia, in spite of enormous public pressure to do so. The apology offered its television audience a touchstone for the Howard era, a comic intervention of wish-fulfilling whimsy and a careful portrait of political character and a razor-sharp critique of hubris. Gillies mounted a show a few years ago called Once Were Leaders, and the title says it all. But why has satire all but disappeared? There's no one like Clarke. No one like Max Gillies. There are the Young Blades, of course, The Chaser, Sammy J, Mark Humphreys, Charlie Pickering. We still have McAuliffe. But satire of the calibre of Clarke and of Gillies is hard to find. If you saw Sammy J's recent sketch, the musical one after the election, where he's crooning a country tune called Queensland, We're Breaking Up With You, you might share my hope for the future. But Sammy is sometimes brilliant and sometimes insipid, fearful, tame. It's great, though, to see the return of the musical sketch in a lot of Sammy J's work. But lest you think all the action is on pay TV or in the online digital space, it isn't. I think the energy is evident in vibrant social satire that follows the tradition of Carol Rae, Barry Humphreys, Nolene Brown, as well as building on it, and it takes the form frequently of stand-up. Stand-up reassuringly brings us back to a simpler theatrical tradition that is direct, social, live and uncomplicated. And of course it can be packaged up for YouTube very easily as well. So I just want to say a few words about Denise Scott. She's the youngest of the actors in the book and the last one I profile. She's developed stand-up and combines comic acting with stand-up, clowning and stand-up together in her long one-woman shows. She's broken a number of taboos in her work, and she's helped to bridge the divide between the two forms. Her obsession with ordinariness and her genuine understanding of women's lives in her humour gives her material a richness and magic, I think. And getting to know Denise for this book forced me to rethink some of my prejudices, I suppose, about stand-up. In her most recent touring show, Disappointments, she appeared with Judith Lucy in a two-woman extravaganza. At the beginning, when the lights went down, a series of gleaming Facebook images appeared on a massive screen showing photographic portraits of the two performers, Denise and Judith, looking perfect, smiling, with their own voiceovers about their lives in a glittering parody of the false way in which people present their lives on social media. After a few minutes, the screen disappeared and the two actors appeared lolling in two large single beds on either side of the upstage area. They were in flannel nightgowns, tucked into big flowery doonas, green ones. And beside them on the bedside table were oversized glasses of red wine. Judith began a monologue about how her life is nothing like the Facebook images the audience has just watched. She explained how she just can't stand being mindful all the time, confessing that she's so glad to have worked out how to lie down in bed and drink at the same time. So I just want to leave you with a very short promo they made at the time of Disappointment so you get the idea of what they do.
It changes every day.
I'm exercising and running exercise classes in stillness. The weight just falls off.
Because it's mindful.
Exactly.
I usually lay in bed for about 15 minutes and just, I not even think.
If you think it, it becomes real.
Some mornings I will run barefoot through a forest. I'll throw a spear. Other mornings I just need to make love.
I myself am starting to learn a trumpet.
People say, you're looking so young.
The word is play trumpet, no dementia.
So there is hope for satire, but it's in unexpected places. The great thing is that it's alive and well on stage, and that is really important. And it's on TV, often in short form and often in musical form. So the magic of John and Max lives on. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, you should come back here. They should do another half marathon. Thanks to our speaker. As I said, profound presentation. We've got copies of Seven Big Australians, Adventures with Comic Actors, for sale after the function. And so we come to questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than the top of the hour. So you come back here, Professor Pender, back here, because you're the star attraction, unfortunately, yes, not me. So there we are. As you pointed out, you've been through about, well, all, in a sense, but a couple, about two or three of the actors here in greater detail. But what is it like to talk to them in private, as you've done a lot? Because someone like Max Gillies, is my memory of Max is, he's one of the most awesomely serious people I've ever met, who keeps on banging on about his causes even when he's in an Adani demonstration, I guess. So is it because Max had Don Watson and later my favourite Marxist comedian Guy Rundle, or is some of this his own work, and how do you contrast his awesomely serious personal side with his hilarious stage performances?
Yeah, well, you're right. He is extraordinarily serious when you talk to him, and he talks for a long time, and he has a photographic memory as well. So it was extraordinary talking to him, because he would remember all the lines of sketches, and he would remember all the personalities of the TV producers he worked with and all the problems he had, even the phone calls he had to various directors and producers at the ABC that he felt were trying to stop him doing things. So He is very serious. He's very analytical. He has strong views about things. I mean, to answer your question, Jared, it was just marvellous. He's like a walking encyclopedia. He remembered so much about the performing group as well and the work he did before that. So He is a really knowledgeable, a really intelligent man. He's a lover of music. So you cover, in a day, you cover 25 subjects in great depth. I don't know if that does answer your question. I hope so.
Okay, so Anne, up there.
Anne, how did you choose the actors or the comedians that you put in the book? I'm thinking of some that might have been in, the Catherine Hume characters and Jerry Connolly.
Yeah.
Where do you place them and how did you choose your group?
I wanted to choose actors who were working in different forms so that I had a representative of the different forms. So, for example, Tony Sheldon is mainly in musical comedy and hasn't done television. So that was really what determined it. The strength of their contribution to the culture and to our imagination, and the fact that they worked in very different forms. So that was, and I wanted to just do seven, because it's too long to do too many, and seven very, very strong personalities. Because I wasn't just talking about their work, I was talking about their lives as well. And they are all very strong personalities.
So there's a question here. We're just getting a microphone. And you just stay where you are.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
You've mentioned the serious quality of comedians, and particularly Max Gillies when he was expounding his views about various issues. Some comedians in other countries, I think that Ukraine and Italy as well, have achieved actual office representing themselves and their views. How long before we have a McCabe-ism in the Prime Minister?
I don't know. I mean, he did do that show with John in it about the XPM. I don't think it will happen here, somehow. I think Australians are way too sensible. But what do you think?
Well, I think Boris is the latest example of
that. Was he an actor?
The suggestion was for those who didn't pick it up that Boris Johnson is an example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
So there's a question here. John, just speak up loudly until the microphone comes. Here, come on.
Okay. Oh, so start now?
Yep.
You didn't mention Barry Humphries.
I didn't.
And
can I have to say he's the only one, I think, that's of those that's made it overseas and made a remark once that other Australian comedians were very funny. And I'm just wondering about, if you took sex out of his humour, what would there be left? Because all the things I can think of that Dame Edna or Sir Les Paterson, which might have been a job at Sydney, by the way, that's another question, but would be funny without sex. And for what it's worth, somehow as an undergraduate, I discovered Kraft Ebing's textbook of psychosexual disorders, and for the life of me, Barry Humphries worked that into an episode of Barry McKenzie that I saw in Private Eye. So what can you tell us about Humphries, whom you didn't mention, and his character, and how these characters of Amy Edner and Sir Les Paterson and Sandy Stone evolved?
Yeah, well, I spent a lot of time with Barry as well, and as I said, I did a full biography of Barry some years ago. Barry's in a lot of trouble at the moment, as you may know, for his comments about transgender people, and they've taken the Barry Award, the name of the Barry Award, away. And he did make some really offensive comments. I think it's a shame that it's wiped from the history, that name. But I think, you know, Barry's really, really important for the development of Australian comedy and satire. But I think it is mainly of historic interest now. I think a lot of people don't even know who he is. So he was really important, and people like Denise really observed Barry's style closely, and especially the audience interaction, the way of working the audience. She has copied that and she's got it down. So he's been really important in so many ways, and those characters have been really important. And as you say, he is the only one who has really made it. But he ran into trouble in the US too, the same thing, identity politics. So he reached a bit of a limit over there because of some of the offensive things he said.
But he is still performing at the age of what?
He's still performing, 85. He's got a new tour about to begin. He did a Behind the Mask tour last year. He's about to do an Edna tour. as far as I know.
But with the change in environment, a lot of comedians from the 50s and earlier, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s wouldn't be able to perform these days, would they? They'd offend too many people.
Well, they do. I mean, sometimes comedy is really offensive and people get shut down all the time.
But they didn't get shut down in the 50s and 60s. I mean, Humphreys would have been shut down half a century ago if the current level of offence was inactive then.
People really did criticise him, though. He really, really came in for it.
But he kept going.
He kept going. He was bold.
I was at performances where he said things, if you said now, that shut down the theatre. But no one sort of cared. Now we've got a question here, and then we've got one, Margaret.
Well, I do remember one of Barry Humphrey's characters was Les Boyle from the ACUNT. I'm sure there would be bans on him now and street demonstrations and today. But Anne, just taking from the gentleman in front and Jared's expanding the point, do you think that political correctness today is such that one can't freely express a satirical point of view?
No, because I think people are expressing a satirical point of view, but they have to live with the consequences. Barry has to live with the consequences of what he said. And we may not agree. We may think those actions that they took were extreme, but that's what happens. So I think people still say the things.
By the way, the character Boyle was a trade union official.
Lance Boyle.
kind of CFWMEU guy from a certain earlier generation.
With a moustache that went like that. Yeah.
Margaret.
My question was along the same lines, about to what degree do you think political correctness has shut down the freedom of speech that's needed for satire and comedy? And I'm a university professor, and I have students coming to me and saying things like, well, I agree with what you said, but I would never say so in public. And one word that one of my students used recently was, I asked him why not, and he said, because the consequences would be too dire. That's a very strong word. They're frightened.
I think, but if you go to a stand-up show, you'll hear everything. So people have got that freedom, but they've got to be careful about what it creates and the reaction. They have to live with the reaction. So I think, for example, on the ABC, I think they're being very, very careful at the moment. So I think while Sammy J is really brilliant, he's a bit tepid sometimes. He's careful. They are being careful. But I don't think that's necessarily problematic because he's very clever as well.
But in stand-up, you'd be able to laugh at Christians, but you wouldn't be able to laugh at Muslims, would you?
But they do laugh at Muslims. There are Muslim comedians laughing at their families and laughing at other people.
But everyone does that, but, you know.
I don't know. I think you get everything in stand-up.
Well, put it this way. You can laugh at straight Christians, but it's hard to laugh at gay Christians, isn't it?
I don't know. I challenge you to go to a comedy festival. And
the last stand-up I went to, one of the people in the audience was performing, so I go to a few. Okay, now where are we? John. John, okay. Just stay back here.
Thank you for a very interesting address, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. Another field where Australians have made a mark is in the business of cartooning. Two questions. Do you see much of a connection between cartoons and satire? And secondly, you're pessimistic about satire. Are you pessimistic about cartooning these days?
Oh, I think cartooning's flourishing. I suppose there is a connection in some ways, but of course the comedy I'm talking about and dealing with is verbal primarily, so whereas cartooning is visual. So they are very different, and the person gets to perform rather than just be that one image, that one clever image, as you have in a cartoon. So yeah, there's a connection in some ways, and the zeitgeist you might get in cartooning might resemble something of the performers, but they're very, very different forms.
There's a question here.
Yes, I thank you for sharing your... this is a fantastic evening.
Thanks.
That you've shared with us. Yeah. Just across the way, we could spit at it, and it was Phillip Street. And TGB had a studio there, and Bob Dyer and Jack Davey used to be there. I was allowed to go there with my mates from Mossman, and my Loretto mother didn't seem to mind at all. And that's how I learnt about risque jokes. And of course, she took me to the Peep Show. And so the seeding of all of this began in my life at that point. Have you any comments about that as a genesis for later developments?
Well, perhaps you might just background Jack Davey.
Well, not really. I mean, I think Humphreys and characters like Les Patterson obviously are really vulgar, you know. So if that's what you mean, is that what you're getting at? That there's a vulgarity in some of that humour that comes through?
It's not vulgar, but it exercises your mind. It awakens you.
Yeah. I think the thing that's really...
And it puts a smile on your face.
Yeah, well, that's true. And Barry is probably the exception in this group, that he does go to the vulgar, whereas Clark and Gillies and the others, they rarely obscene, rarely do anything like that, that risque. It's just not part of their humour.
John again, yeah.
Can I just add to the comment that was made with an additional comment that Phillip Street, you'll remember in the 50s and early 60s, what was really famous was the Phillip Street Theatre.
Yeah.
Where they had the reviews, and Gordon, that's the way Gordon Chater came to.
Yeah, and they were risque. Yeah, right. They really were risque.
Yes.
But pretty tame by our standards.
Yes, I would have been allowed to go if they weren't pretty tame by that.
And Barry certainly performed there, as did Carol Ray and Nolene. They were all at Phillip Street. Yeah. But that was a very English kind of review satire. It was really quite safe.
What about the location of your... the birthplace of your... the people you're dealing with here? Humphreys is... Melbourne, Clark's New Zealand, Gillies is Melbourne, couple of Brits. Where's Sydney?
Well, Carol obviously was English, but she came to Sydney very much lived in Sydney. Nolene, Sydney.
Nolene.
She was born in Sydney. She worked in that little Marrickville theatre, and she worked, her whole career was in Sydney. Yeah. Tony also is Sydney, although he was born in Melbourne, but he worked most of his life and still works in Sydney.
Okay, now Miss someone? Anne, yeah.
There is some truth, though, that political correctness has played a role in the way in which people react to comedy. Take Bill Legg, for example. I mean, Bill Legg was almost... I mean, he did die suddenly after the great fracas about his cartoon, which was misinterpreted by heaps of people. How much is social media, the fact that we're all connected now so quickly, having an effect on people being able to shut down what they don't like? And I think that does affect people's freedom to sling as far as they want to sling their sense of humour or their satire. I mean, comedy has always got itself tangled up with controversy a little bit.
Yeah.
But today it's become a screaming, moralistic kind of opposing of it. And I think that you have to sort of... Can you consider
I'll just give you an example of... Last year I was in the US, and you will remember there was an awful cartoon of Serena Williams after the drama at the US Open final. And I was quite shocked, really, at the visceral reaction to that in the US. People were appalled that that had been published, and really, really reacted very strongly. They really hated it, and they really you know, they said, this is the country you come from, and how is... And that actually surprised me, just the strength of the reaction. I thought some of what they said was valid, but I was really surprised at how it hurt so much. So it's so context dependent. Over there, that was how 95% of people, I'd say, felt. So that's all I can say. And I had to respect that. I wasn't going to say anything about that.
Just on the political side, in your group, Humphreys was, I mean, he was always laughing at coalition governments, but essentially he's a conservative. Now, if you look at the modern group of, and you mentioned McAuliffe, Charlie Pickering, Dan Illick has said, and others, I mean, they see themselves as left-wing activists as well as comedians. They give left-wing lectures on environment and other matters constantly, and they say they do it. So there don't seem to be any conservative comedians around anymore. I mean, have they been driven out of town? Because Humphreys was the most prominent of his generation, but now, Gilly's the same. I mean, it's essentially a left-wing product, isn't it, in Australia?
I think it's fair to say that those satirists might be broadly on the left, but their humour, their satire, they'd be castigating everybody. You know, they don't... I mean, John and Max.
Well, do they castigate the Greens? They have a go at Labour. That's a soft target. But they never go at Bob Brown or Dean Atali or the Green Left. I mean, they're sacred. They never touch them.
Or transvestite?
Well,
they're our sacred cows now, like they never were before.
Yeah, but I think that Labour came in for a lot. I mean, Bill Shorten wanted in connection with two knifings.
Yeah,
that was Shorten.
I'm talking about
targets. But still, it's fairly even-handed.
But Labour's not the left. No. Labour's the Social Democrats.
Yeah.
Conservative Social Democrats. The left is the Green Left. Or in the olden days, it was the Communist Party. No one laughs at the Green Left these days. I mean, Humphreys would.
Yeah.
But
Humphreys,
who else of the living group would?
I don't see Pickering as that, you know, that sort of politically barbed, actually. Well, it's a news show.
I'll publish one of his Green Left lectures in my Media Watchdog blog next Friday for your
attention. But on his show.
From his show. From his show, yeah.
I think it's pretty mild.
Another thing to add to this, though. I remember about 20 years ago when some Jewish comedian started to laugh at the Holocaust. That, I think, is where, you know, it came to a point where within their own cultural group, I remember going to a play, they were laughing at the fact that their parents kept hammering and hammering and hammering. It was sort of a reaction within the cultural group. So maybe we have to wait until some of these things become more normalised. Is that a possibility?
Possibly, and this is no comparison, but that sketch that I showed about 1975 was 10 years after. A lot of people could not laugh at that for a very long time, and it's nothing like what you're talking about, the Holocaust. But there is Holocaust humour, and there is 9/11 humour in the United States.
Now, we're getting very close.
Laughing at the death camps, they were laughing at the generation later and the way they
brought the way they behaved, yeah, they did.
We're getting very close to the end. Have I missed anyone?
Start again.
Start again, he says. Okay, so just you've done a book on Humphreys. You've done a book on these seven comic actors. You're going to continue working in this field?
I hope to, but at the moment I'm working on literary writers, Geraldine Brooks and Peter Carey at the moment. So a slightly different, but expatriate writers, Australians in the US.
And very successful ones, yeah.
Yeah.
Look, thanks to Professor Anne Pender for an important paper and a lively question and discussion time. It's been a lot of fun, and a lot of important points have been made. And this is a very significant book. So, as I said, we've got copies of Seven Big Australians, Adventures with Comic Actors, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign copies. We've had you here with talking on Barry Humphreys, this time with the seven comic actors. We'll have you back with your next one on some of our overseas literary figures. But for tonight, congratulations and good luck with the book.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast.
This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.